Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Happy New Year to you. Welcome to our first show of 2026. Hope you had a great holiday season and are ready to dig in. I know I am, and hopefully our co-host is too. Jeremy Branch, welcome.
I always love New Year's, and it's not because it's some magical restart, but it's an opportunity to try to be a slightly better version of ourselves, right? So on this episode, I promise I'm going to keep the vibes light, positive, and appropriate for the beginning of a new start as much as I can.
Do you is that your resolution, or do you have any, like, are you into the whole New Year's resolution thing, anything like that?
That's a good question. And I think, yeah, I kind of summed it up. It's just as long as I'm making progress, be it financial, be the way that I react to conflict and the way that I kind of compose myself, I just always want to be a slightly better version of the person and kind of elevate who I am, you know?
That's a good way to look at it. I like that. That's very positive, you know. I think we could all always be just a little bit better than we were.
And it's so easy to set resolutions and sometimes not live up to those and kind of beat ourselves up about it, which I find counterproductive. But for those people that did set resolutions, best of luck to you. Hang in there. There's a lot of things that can get in the way of it. But also, ultimately, it's about just pursuing a better version of you.
I hear you. I'm personally trying to tighten the belt. In more ways than one. I'm trying to reapply myself to the diet and exercise plan that I've been on the past few years. I've kind of fallen off a little bit this year.
Okay.
And trying to spend a little less too.
I hear that. Yeah, that's definitely a big part of mine as well.
So we'll see how that goes. But no matter what, we're going to be here for you folks every Saturday here on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Or, of course, anytime you want to listen via the podcast version of the show, which is available whenever you want, wherever you get your podcasts. That is not changing in the new year. So, and we will continue to bring you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. And I think this week, Jeremy, it's fair to say there's really only one thing that's been going on. I mean, there's been movies that have come out and whatever, but there's only one thing everybody's talking about. There's only one thing that's in the zeitgeist. And we talk sometimes about the death of the monoculture.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, we've gotten away from this period where everybody's watching the same thing and talking about the same thing. But, you know, I think we have had at least one example of that this week. And that's Stranger Things.
That's a really good point.
I feel like it's been the only thing I've been hearing people talking about for the last few days. In both nationally and locally. And I will add that, you know, locally, we're adding to that conversation with Pensacon. We just announced on the day of the finale on New Year's Eve that we're going to have two of the stars of Stranger Things coming to Pensacon 2026 in February. Cara Buono, who plays Karen Wheeler, the mom of the Wheeler clan, Nancy and Mike and Holly. And we're also going to have everybody's favorite science teacher and AV club mentor, Mr. Clark, Randy Havens, will be here as well.
Talk about some amazing guests.
Well, you know, of course, I'm a fan of Stranger Things going back to the beginning. And we're going to get into that in depth. This is not going to just be, we're going to have to do the whole show today about Stranger Things. It's not going to just be about the finale. It's going to be kind of absorbing this series as a whole over five seasons and close to 10 years and what the impact has been and that sort of thing. But both of those actors got to step up this season in a way they haven't in previous seasons.
Talk about serendipitous timing.
Yeah, they were both more central to the plot this year than they've ever been. They both kind of got brought into the loop where they both were very much outside of the loop before this year. So yeah, it's an exciting time to have both of those. We're lucky that schedules worked out that we were able to get them here for PenceCon, and we're very excited about that. So if you haven't already gotten your PenceCon tickets and you're a Stranger Fans thing, make sure you do. Go to PenceCon.com. We just put single day tickets on sale on January 1st, but of course the weekend passes are still your best value. Those are available too. But head to PenceCon.com, pick up those tickets, and hopefully we see you there February 20th through 22nd, and you get a chance to meet them and a bunch of other people that you enjoy throughout pop culture. Great guest list this year, as always, and a lot of great other events going on as part of PenceCon that we're very excited about. But so, yeah, that has aided in the conversation locally. You know, there, it has been something that, as the conversation has gone on amongst people that live in the community, it's been a part of the conversation. But this is obviously an international phenomenon. You know, Stranger Things has been a zeitgeist show in a way that we have fewer of these days. Like, you know, as we were saying, the monoculture. You know, what's the last series finale that you remember being this much excitement around and this much discussion of? Whether positive or negative.
I feel like we're in very similar territory to where we were when HBO ended Game of Thrones, and that's for better and worse.
Oh, agreed. Agreed. Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
That is a show that I think a lot of people cited as the last example of the monoculture because it had such a big audience and it was still on traditional cable TV. Which Stranger Things is not, but it felt like the last appointment show. I don't think that's true, but it felt like it at the time. And the fact that the next one that everybody's focused on is a streaming show kind of says something about where we are, because do we still have a monoculture? Yes and no. I mean, I think that Stranger Things shows that in some ways we do. And that monoculture is probably first and foremost centered on Netflix. Netflix is by far the largest streaming service in the world, definitely in the U.S. And there is no other entertainment outlet that is as widely viewed. And I think it's probably even fair to say that theatrical cinematic releases are maybe not as viewed as Netflix. And there are other things you can cite along the way that are examples of, well, everybody's watching and talking about this. I mean, I think you can say that about K-pop Demon Hunters. I think you could say that about Squid Game. I think during the pandemic, you could definitely say that about Tiger King.
Yeah.
You know, well, I mean,
what's interesting about Stranger Things, it is truly for all generations, right? Like, there's cast members that can reflect any different demographic, which I think makes it transcend things like even Game of Thrones, where adults may be wary of letting kids watch it, or Squid Games. And then on the flip side of that, maybe there's a big audience of young adults to adults that wouldn't watch K-pop Demon Hunters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, they really kind of, you know, and we'll talk about this a little more after the break, but the Duffer Brothers kind of came up with a concoction that maybe shouldn't have worked. But it does, in that it does hit on so many different audiences, even though it's being the same show. I mean, for folks that are, you know, our age or maybe a little older, a little younger, you know, there's the 80s nostalgia side of it. You know, it taps into the stuff that we loved at the time and the stuff that, you know, the stuff that we did when we were that age.
Yeah.
You know, that it's been so funny to see some of the reactions to this show from other generations, where they think things are unrealistic that happened in the series. And we're definitely going to talk about that some more versus for me, I am exactly the same age as the core group of kids in this show, Dustin and Mike and Lucas and Will and Eleven and Max. You know, the series, with the risk of spoiling, ends with their graduation in 1989. It's the year I graduated.
That's pretty cool.
Pretty dead on with a lot of those things. But we'll talk about that more after the break. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. My co-host, Jeremy Branch, is on the line with me. And, you know, we were talking before the break, we're talking about Stranger Things. And we're going to get into the details of the finale and the last season a little later in the show. So I'm going to go ahead and give you an early spoiler warning now. But we wanted to talk first kind of about the overall impact of the series and about how maybe this is one of the last examples of the monoculture and the overall impact that it has had on pop culture. And I think you need to look no further than that song that we just heard, Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush, used very heavily in season 4 and, you know, used more than once in season 5 as well. But that song, which had been, you know, not really necessarily the most well-known song out of the 80s. It was a top 40 hit. It was Kate Bush's, I think, her first top 40 hit in the U.S., but very low on the charts. Came back with a vengeance after it was used in Stranger Things. Became got as high as number 3 in the U.S.
Oh, wow.
And ended up topping the charts in the U.K. Broke all kinds of records and, you know, just, you know, became omnipresent in a way that things don't do unless they're part of a monoculture. So,
yeah,
you know, I mean, Stranger Things, I think, has had enough of a wide-based appeal that it can do that. It also, you know, put Metallica's Master of Puppets into the top 40 after its use in season 4. That song, when it was initially released, did not even make the charts.
It's a good song too.
So and it became a top 40 hit something like almost 40 years later.
Yeah.
You know, so you know, it's that impact. And there's been a number of songs over the course of this series that you can point at that had a revival in interest and a revival in airplay and a revival in sales because of the use in Stranger Things. Whether they made the charts again or not may be another story, but going all the way back to season 1, The Clash, Should I Stay or Should I Go?
Mm-hmm.
You know, took on a new life. Never Ending Story by Lamal. With the use in, I think it was season 3, if I remember correctly.
It was.
Yeah. You know, with that, the big number with Gaten Matarazzo and I forget the actress's name that played his girlfriend at the time. That's a character that's a thread we can pick up on at some point too, is whatever happened to Susie?
Yeah, that's one of a few. But while we're on the topic of monoculture, I do think the music is very key to that. I also, as you were talking about before the break, as someone yourself who is the same age as the characters, you're also now around the same age as maybe Joyce and Hopper, and you've gone through the experience of being a parent, and then a lot of the children have become teens, so there's a teen audience that's built into it. I think what has contributed to it being a monoculture is that almost every member of the family can connect to it in at least one way, and I think that's really contributed. And then another thing that I think we have to touch on as far as why it's been as big as it has, and especially in this final season, is because they made the massively bold choice of releasing this on Christmas and on New Year's, which, I mean, that's when everybody is home unless they're out celebrating. But it was an interesting release schedule, and I think it has no choice but to, like, have a big chunk of the conversation because families were at home together watching this together.
Yeah, well, let's take those points one at a time. You know, going back to what you're saying about, I do think this is a show that had multi-generational appeal. Mm-hmm. And I think that some of it is because you get the audience that is the same age as the younger kids in the show. Some of it is you get the audience that's the same age as the older kids in the show, and some of it is you get the audience that is the age of the parents that is looking at it both from a nostalgia standpoint and from a current parental standpoint.
That's so, really interesting.
So, I mean, I think it has made, for lack of a better term, heroes of all of these different age groups of characters. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, gives everybody a chance to see themselves in somebody in the show. And for somebody like myself, that is, as I mentioned, the same age as the younger characters in terms of They graduated at the end of the series in 1989. I graduated high school in 1989. You might see yourself in both, you know, the adult characters and the younger characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that maybe, you know, maybe for those of us who fall into that category, maybe that makes the show even just a little bit more precious. I don't know. But I think it's interesting because you get that younger audience, the mainly the Gen Z and what are we calling the after Gen Z? Is it Gen Alpha?
Uh-huh.
Is that what we're calling them? Is that what we've decided
on? I think so.
This week? Yeah, I'm sure it'll be something else next week.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's been interesting to see the reactions that you see on social media, wherever, about things being unrealistic in the show. That having the perspective of somebody who was there, for lack of a better term, are absolutely dead on. I mean, I remember
in with one specific example, because I'm curious about
well,
this.
Well, in the early seasons, yeah, they were mostly younger kids that were freaking out about, there's no way these kids would be out at all hours without any parental supervision, and that their parents had no idea where they were, and, you know, they were just roaming the streets. And it's like, dude, yes, we did. That was the 80s. We were all feral street children, and, you know, maybe you had to be home when the street lights came on. Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. That is absolutely 100% dead on realistic. I can promise you with very little doubt in my mind that most of the time my parents had no idea where I was and what I was doing.
Yeah. Yeah. I concur. I totally agree with that.
And there was just a brand of free range parenting that went on in the 80s that does not go on today. And that may be because, yeah, you know, the generation that is raising the kids of today were those kids. And mm-hmm. they know what they were up to.
Yeah, very, very true.
I mean, you know, I honestly think that's very much the case. I think that's a big part of why, you know, parental attitudes have changed over the years. You know, I think that, you know, the latchkey generation grew up not wanting to put their kids through that, for lack of a better term. They wanted to be there for their kids more than their parents were for them. And so now the result is these kids think that this is totally unrealistic because no parent would ever do that. Well, kids, there's a reason your parents don't do that. And that's because that's...
If that was anybody's sticking point, I am shocked to hear it. I had no idea that would be the thing that somebody pointed to as being unrealistic Vecna.
I definitely heard a lot of that in the early seasons, and I think as time has gone on, there's been some other things. There's something that is in particular this season that I want to touch on, but I want to do that a little later when we get into the spoilers. But there was a big scene in the next to last episode that got a lot of reactions that I have a lot of thoughts about. But one of them is the thought that the way it was handled was unrealistic. And I can tell you again, because I was there, no, it wasn't.
Well, if we're talking about cultural impact, I think it's fair to kind of discuss a little bit of the discourse, so we don't have to dedicate a whole lot of the actual, like, episode to it. But specifically, what are you referring to?
Well, I let's save that for a little later when we get into the spoiler discussion. I think it's absolutely a discussion, but I think it is a spoiler. And given that we're just a couple of days after the final episode dropped, I do want to hold the spoilers for later in the show. So I will again put up a spoiler warning here. The last half of the show, we will talk about spoiler aspects of the series, and especially of the last few episodes. So if you haven't watched yet for some reason, if you found something better to do the night of Christmas Day and the night of New Year's Eve, or even New Year's Day, because most of us were off New Year's Day, I think, you know, maybe we didn't have as much to do versus Christmas Day. Maybe you had family stuff to do. Although, you know, the episodes dropped at night on Christmas Day. So that's kind of something I wanted to bring up too, because you mentioned that the impact of releasing those episodes on the holidays and everybody's at home together, for lack of a better term. That is has not always been a tradition in U.S. television, but it definitely has been a tradition in U.K. television.
Interesting.
That where, you know, you'd have big shows that would release big episodes on Christmas Day because they'd have a big audience of people at home all gathered around the television together. And Doctor Who in particular was very well known for its Christmas specials. Among other shows, there have been, I think last year they had the final episode of Gavin and Stacey, which is a very well-loved British comedy series. they did that on Christmas Day, you know, that sort of thing. So it has been a thing that has been of impact that I don't think necessarily has been of impact here. And I think it's interesting because I think there's a lot of things you can say that about. That I think that in terms of the British model of a lot of things like that has come to the States in part with the wave of streaming. Like the British series have always been shorter series. They've been, you know, the seasons, they call them series there, but the seasons would be, you know, mm-hmm. 8 episodes maybe. And then it might be 3 years before they did another season. You know,
I see a lot of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, that model has definitely come to the U.S., you know? So it's
what
interesting.
What do you think about the release schedule, like personal preference wise?
Obviously, you know, when you're a fan, you want stuff and you want it now.
Mm-hmm.
But I am also the standpoint that I would rather them take the time and get it right than rush it out and maybe it ends up being a subpar product.
I wonder if they would have released the whole thing together, if it would have given people less an opportunity to sour on specific things, because you posted on Facebook. Now that's how you stick the landing. And I completely agree with that. But I also think there were some major missteps leading up to that would have been a lot easier to digest had we been able to jump right into the next thing.
Okay, well, let's take a break and we'll talk about that. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host and weekend lover, Julio Diaz. My co-host Jeremy Branch is on the line with us. I'm not anybody's weekend lover. It's just a fantasy.
Hello.
On my part. But yeah, you know, I mean, God, man, that song is so great. Prince was so
incredible.
Prince was so damn amazing. But if you know that we're talking about Stranger Things on the show today, that should be, if you've seen the final episode already, you know why I'm playing that song. If you have not seen the final episode already, from here on in, we're in complete spoiler territory for the rest of the show. If you have not watched the finale of Stranger Things yet, press pause on your podcast. If you're listening on the podcast, if you're listening live, come back and listen to the rest on the podcast later. Cause we are going to get into spoilers of the final season and the finale in particular. And, you know, one of the things that was building my anticipation of the final episode was the Duffer brothers out there talking about how they'd scored this epic needle drop for the climax of the series. And they were beside themselves and they felt like the only reason they got it to happen was because of the impact that Kate Bush had the season before. And mm-hmm. that Kate Bush being such an artist and her letting her music being used and it having this positive impact convinced the people that had the rights to this song to go ahead and let them have it. And there was a lot of speculation about what that song might be. And that's what it was, Purple Rain. They not only used Purple Rain, they also used When Doves Cry.
One of my favorites.
Yeah. But, you know, both very, very major impactful songs of the 1980s. And really both kind of cemented where we were at the climax of this series. You know, you had that, you had the celebratory of When Doves Cry, and then the more, I guess, melancholy or mournful, even
sentimental, mournful, sure,
yeah, of Purple Rain. And that kind of, I think, sums up where we are in the finale. But let's backtrack just a minute and get to where we are in the overall season. Now, you mentioned before the break, Jeremy, that you thought that the reception of this season maybe was a little varied because of the release schedule.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways to engage with fandom. Psychologically, I actually heard that people bond deeper when they share about things that they dislike, which I find interesting. When we have these things that we love and we get to the end of them, there's this hyperfixation on being extremely critical of every single thing that happens. All eyes are on what they do right, but it seems like even more on what they do wrong. And I think there's a space for all of that. I also think that there are large bad faith segments that, who's even to say if they're fans or not, that they see anything that they perceive to be pushing a progressive agenda as an affront to their sensibilities. So there's also this whole big group of people that were able to review bomb real heavy after something that you had teased in the last segment. But for me, I just want to say, I love this series. I think it's had highs and lows. I think the season 5 was a mess. And I didn't have some bloodlust or this death wish to kill everybody off. I think when you and I were kind of talking about that, my whole reasoning was that these characters, there's so many of them that were introduced that maybe it would be a meaningful arc to lose some of them. They didn't really go that direction, and that's okay. It ended up not being that kind of show. But I feel like because the cast got as big as it did, the plot got extremely unwieldy. There were some little nitpicks that I think are extremely valid, but I will say, for me, season 5 was a chaotic mess.
I did not feel that way. I mean, I right. get what you're saying about the cast being a little oversized and, you know, maybe certain characters didn't get served as much as they might have. And maybe if we'd had, you know, one or two more episodes or something, maybe that would resolve that. But I never felt like it was a mess. I never felt like I was losing the thread. I never felt like it wasn't telling the story that it set out to tell.
For me, emotional arcs are so much more important than like cool set pieces and stuff. But I will say, just the way that the Demogorgons were powered completely according to what the scene required of them, to the point that Karen's able to wound one with a shard of a wine bottle, but then there are 12 fully armed military soldiers basically all shooting directly at each other. There's no friendly fire. They shoot the Demogorgon 1,000 times and it doesn't even slow it down. For me, that's the rule of cool over the rule of consistency.
I guess, but I don't really necessarily have a problem with that. In fairness, I don't think, you know, I think there can be a thing where something can be stunned and, you know, maybe she hit it in a sensitive spot that the gunfire didn't hit it in. Because I feel like she did hit the Demogorgon like right in its like open mouth, right?
But they did that to the Demo Dogs, and I know Demo Dogs are maybe not as strong as Demogorgons, but at that last chase scene in the hospital. Anyways, we could get really
into
bogged
the weeds.
Down in that kind of stuff, because I do think that tends to happen when all eyes are on, are they going to pull this off perfectly? Holly was great, don't get me wrong, but I thought it was a kind of crazy choice to introduce this main pivotal character at a point when we should really be worried about making sure that the characters already in play get the most out of their screen time.
Which character are you thinking of in that regard?
That could have gotten better served.
No, which new character do you feel like was introduced that
Oh, Holly. And again, it's not that Nell Fisher wasn't great, and I see how introducing her makes this last scene that we're going to talk about later hit even harder. But I feel like Eleven almost felt like a side character this season, which is kind of crazy to me.
I have heard that concern. I don't necessarily disagree with it, but I think that this was kind of the, like, the climax of Eleven's journey was already there. You know, I don't, so yes, but not really. And the thing with Holly is Holly's been there since the start.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
Yeah, she may not have been
a doormat that was there at the beginning, but we didn't need to set up a whole arc for it.
Well, but I think there's a couple of things here. Bringing Holly in makes the impact on the Wheeler family more personal. Putting Holly in that situation makes the impact on the Wheeler family more personal. And I think the Wheeler family, at least at the start, was as much central to Stranger Things as Eleven was. I think this all started in Mike's basement.
Yes.
And it all ends in Mike's basement.
Which is beautiful. And we should get to that. But let's talk first about the thing that you said that we started talking about last segment about Will.
So it's one of those things, again, you know, I think a lot of the things that we saw at the end of this were very much foreshadowed along the way. And when there's a negative reaction to those things that have been built up clearly and meticulously over 5 seasons, I have to wonder what show were the people that are complaining watching? Were they not paying attention? Were they not really watching it? Were they double screening or whatever? Because the journey of Will coming to accept himself and who he is as a young gay man has been telegraphed since season one.
Maybe I wouldn't go that far back, but I totally agree. It's always been core to the character.
The Duffers, I read an interview with them, the Duffer brothers who created the series, where they said, we're a lot of things, but subtle isn't one of them.
Yeah.
And, yep. You know, I think that's fair to say. You know, I just don't see how anybody didn't see that coming and why that would be then a cause to attack other than, you just don't want to see gay people anywhere.
That's a big, big part of it.
I mean, I'm sure that's
me, and I didn't review bomb it, but
I'm sure that some of it. I'm sure that some of the review bombing is coming from people that don't even watch the show.
Yes.
That just go out of their way to attack any depiction of homosexuality in media.
100%.
But some of it did come from people that watch the show, and I don't get it. And then the flip side is there has been some hate from the other side of people that wanted Will and Mike to become a couple. And again, what show were you watching?
Uh-huh.
Mike likes girls. They're best of friends, and you can love somebody without wanting to be in a relationship with somebody, a romantic relationship with somebody. So, you know, it's some of this fan expectation stuff detracts from what's actually on the screen. I think we should judge the things by what's actually on the screen. And that means you got to pay attention to what's actually on the screen. We got to take a break.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'll let you say that when we come back. Listen, let's go up and scroll on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Jeremy Branch, my co-host, is on the line. And we are talking about the overall impact, but really now we're getting into the final season of Stranger Things and the finale in particular. So spoiler warnings, I know it just came out a couple of days ago, but we wanted to be part of the conversation right at the start. So if you have not seen the final episode of Stranger Things, we are talking about the finale in depth. Jeremy, you started to say something right before the break. Please go ahead with what you were going to say.
This is such a nuanced conversation. I know we could delve into it for an eternity, but I believe, like, as you said earlier, we should absorb what's on the screen, but age is important and arcs are important. And I would rather the characters be served than have some crazy action sequence. I felt that Will's arc of coming out was handled better at the end of part one of this release when his eyes turned white and he found his inner thing. Now, I know he still needed to come out, but what if he would have come out before that and it unlocked his powers? Because instead it kind of had to reset him, and the timing was crazy. And I say that to say, it's not specific to that scene, because I also felt the time that Max and Holly had that conversation, it was beautifully acted right before they each go through their own portals. But it was wild timing for Max to be telling her that when we know these portals are only open for a finite amount of time. So it's not about the content. It's about the where they fit it in to the story. And I don't envy anybody who's in the situation of creating the last season of a beloved show. But those were a couple of things that just, they felt weird to me. That said, the prologue to the big epic battle sequence, it works so incredibly well for me that I almost forgive everything else in season five, because they ended it on such a wonderful note.
I partially disagree with you. I was kind of screaming at the TV when the Max and Holly conversation was going on. Run, run, run.
Uh-huh.
So I get what you're coming at, but you gotta suspend a little bit of disbelief.
Right.
You know, but the coming out I thought was handled beautifully. I had no problem with it. And I think it was kind of them rallying around Will, who was really the kind of the start of all this to begin with. And
yeah,
thematically, I think it holds.
I felt like he went through that transformation just for the next release to be like, oh, I'm actually not ready to fight. I can't use my powers. There's something I have to do first. Where if that would have happened before the unlocking of his, but it didn't. It didn't. It doesn't matter that much. Before we switch into the epilogue, can we touch on the final set piece with the Mind Flayer coming out and the defeat of Vecna?
Yes.
What did you think about all that?
I thought the battle was epic. It was
awesome looking.
Yeah, it looked great. It was. I'm a little iffy on the decision of Joyce being the one to do the final blow.
Okay.
But like, I was okay with it. And I think they did, the way they handled it with everybody feeling the impact of it was,
I liked it a lot.
Was great. But to me that the climax was not the defeat of Vecna. The climax was them rushing home in a celebratory mood only to be confronted with the military.
And yeah. What happened to them?
What do you mean? What happened to the military?
Yeah, they were just like, all right, yeah, Hopper shot 50 of us, and Nancy shot like 10 of us, but like, we're going to let bygones be bygones. See y'all later.
Well, I suppose that we could have had 15 more minutes for them to go through all of that, but think of the amount of dirt they had on what the military was doing.
Yeah, what would have been cool is if everybody in Hawkins was out there at the end and saw it go down, so now they have accountability, and they just got to leave with their tail between their legs or something.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a, I said this elsewhere, but I think there's a little bit of a Sunnydale thing going on here, where, you know, if you're a Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan, it comes out at the end of season three that despite Buffy supposedly carrying on her activities in secret, that the rest of the school kind of knew that she was, she was their protector, and they get, there's a ceremony and they give her this class protector award, and you know, it's beautiful. It's a very tear-jerking scene. But I feel like Hawkins kind of knows what these kids did.
Well,
and
like
they don't make a big deal about it. But, you know, And you have the, you know, the controversy of this military was, you know, abducting pregnant women and killing them and subjecting them to torturous experiments, and they kept a whole town under lockdown.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, yeah, we could get into the weeds of what happened there, but that would have added another half an hour to the episode, at least.
As I said, I think we need to come into 2026 on a high note, and I had some negative stuff to get out of the way. But after the defeat of Vecna, when it goes into the epilogue 18 months later, Julio.
So before we get to that, what do you think of that climax of them facing the military and 11 making the decision, or so we think at this time, to sacrifice her own life? And
I think that was perfect. I think that the ending, leaving it up to us, is also just fine. I think it works perfectly for me. I choose to believe, regardless of what the Duffers said, that Elle sacrificed herself, and that's a beautiful arc for her. And so that part really worked for me.
So we get to the epilogue. We have a time jump at the end of the episode, 18 months later. So we go from the fall of 87 to the spring of 89, and the late spring, early summer of 89, with our core kids that we followed from the beginning, now graduating from high school. And they, you know, there's just so much that I loved about this. I love the fact that we get to see the directions that pretty much every character, almost every character, is going in. Yeah, we can quibble. They didn't show us what happened to Murray. You know, whatever. But
don't care that much.
What's that?
I don't care that much about that part.
I would have minded of seeing what happened to Murray, but I didn't notice it at the time either. But then, Dustin's speech as the valedictorian, I thought was fantastic. It actually reminded me very much of my own high school graduation. The valedictorian was a friend of mine, Alyssa Rodriguez. And she kind of took a little bit of a similar tack. She first of all, she was kind of like an alternative punk kid like I was. And I found out years later that there were parents that were calling into the school telling them that they could not possibly allow this girl to be the valedictorian, despite the fact that she'd worked her ass off and was one of the most intelligent people I've ever known. And, you know, earned every bit of being the valedictorian. But she got up and basically gave a speech comparing everybody to cattle. And, you know, about following the herd, and, you know, and it was amazing. So it was kind of the same middle finger in a lot of ways. So I really loved that. And I don't know, you know, I'm in contact with Alyssa peripherally. I think we're Facebook friends. Every once in a while we pop up. I would love to know if she watched it and what she thought of it, but I have not had a chance to reach out to her. But I think that where it really ends and where it needed to end is with the gang back around the table playing D&D together one last time. And it's kind of this closing the door on their childhood. And Mike, as the dungeon master, telling the stories of where he believes they're all going to go from here, and also telling the story of his belief that 11 survived and is somewhere in a beautiful land with three waterfalls, like he'd always been saying. And, you know, it's left up to us to interpret whether Mike knows something or whether, you know, whether he's just putting a happy story on it.
I love the fact that that's what he chooses to believe, and that's what the rest of the group choose to believe, because it gives them, you know, the strength and the optimism to like carry on. And when they're all in tears and each of them comes and puts their D&D sheets back onto the shelf, I just felt it so much. I was like, this is the perfect way to close this story.
And then to just put the bow on it, to have it end with Mike kind of standing in the stairwell looking down and reminiscing, and then Holly and her friends burst through and take over the basement and start to play their own D&D game.
Incredible.
The adventure continues for for a new, for another generation. I really liked that. I just thought it was so good. I really loved the show overall. I think that we haven't felt the impact of the show overall. I feel like this is a finale that will become more appreciated as time goes on. I think haters are going to hate. And to those haters, I would point them to the words of Daryl, Delightful Daryl, also known as another word of Daryl that we can't say here. And his sentiments, which I'm not going to repeat on the air either, but if you've watched, you know where I'm going. If you hate it, I don't agree with you. Sorry. I thought it was fabulous. I thought they stuck the landing. I think this is one of the best. This is one of the better series finales of all time.
Finales. Yeah, I'm with you. I think it was an incredible, epic conclusion with enough time at the end to make us feel the impact of all of it.
So we will be back with more next week, guys. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.